Hello, thanks for your support. Well, my last few weeks have been filled with turmoil, except for the exceptionally great September weather, yes? That, I think, deserves like a million notes, a million times over in worshiping God for. And don't forget to catch the moon tonight. There's like the super moon, 9 o'clock-ish to 11 o'clock-ish. I can't explain scientifically what's happening. It's like the moon, blah, 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 blah. Alignment, blah, 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 blah. Red. Go outside. And I'm glad it's not cloudy. But my turmoil is actually not about this work transition, surprisingly. Even though it is weird and unfamiliar, and I got emotional packing up my office this week. My office is still in my car. That, surprisingly, has been really peaceful. I might get super stressed in a few months. That it might change, but for now, it's been great. As many of you know, a number of years ago, when I first came here, I got a job teaching in a high school, and then I promptly quit. And then I had odd jobs, and I was volunteering around this church as it got started so much that I think at some point they just said, like, we can't get rid of her, so we'll hire her. And that was about 14 years ago. And then, you know, if you break up those years, it's about like 2001 to 2006. I did mostly family stuff, so like youth, kids, marriage, parenting stuff. And then 2006 to 2009, as Lydia referenced, there were the years when our church had a site in Boston South End, so I did a lot of preaching there. And then 2009 to 2015, now, it's been kind of a grab bag of general pastoral stuff. I am now going to subject you to one of my memories of part of my time on staff. So if Karen and Taylor are up for flashing up a slide, this is a sticker of me. You too could become a sticker. So there was one year we decided that for our kids' church program, I would dress up every Sunday as a superhero. So I bought a $12 red cape and wore tights to church every Sunday. And then there was this other guy, Ryan, who was volunteering in our kids' church program. He was like a tall, skinny white guy with a huge red fro. And he also would wear a costume. And we probably scared the daylights out of people walking through the lobby. And what got worse is as the year went on, I was pregnant and I got more and more pregnant. And so actually I was like waddling around in a $12 red cape all winter long. Well, here's how this work change decision happened. I have wondered in the last few years whether it was getting to be time for me to take a step back here and try out different arenas for skills and interests. I've told some of you I've been writing and considering some online communication stuff. And this community is so full of creative, amazing, talented people. And we're really of the philosophy of, like, it's our community, right? It's not a show of a few people. It really is our partnership together. And I just thought, hey, that's great. I've also mentioned some other personal reasons which motivate me to make a change of pace. So recently, periodically, I would find myself half joking with my good friend Ivy. It's like, Ivy, you should take my job. Ivy had a part-time admin job with the church. And I actually did admin work a number of years ago for several years, and I loved it. So I'd say, you should do my job, and I should do yours. Well, Ivy, actually being a spiritual person, stopped joking about it and started praying. And through that process, she thought, I think it's God. And between the two of us, you know, I actually prayed occasionally about it. And I thought, oh, this is totally great. Maybe God's providing for this change for me, for her, and maybe for our whole community, which was exciting. And with the timing of our new academic calendar year, we just thought, maybe it's better now than like in 6 months when we're right in the middle of the year. Well, once it was clear that my departure from staff was actually happening, because I'm kind of present-oriented, I asked God, so who do I talk to for my next work? Like, who could help me out? And immediately, three names came to mind. None of them obviously connected with each other. Michael Dortch, a friend in our church who moved to Paris, with his wife, Kathy. Scott and Louise Walker. And Amanda Proctor. I just saw Nathan. Where are you? There. Okay, so Michael, Scott and Louise, a couple other of my friends who work in HR were tremendously helpful. Then Amanda comes into my office one day, and we're sitting there. And I said, Amanda, I don't know exactly why your name came to mind when I was praying, but it was clear that it was like this crystal clear thought. So could you just talk to me about work? Like, how have you made your work choices, and where do you feel like God's in that? So she starts talking. And she starts describing how she and her husband Nathan have made their work choices. Like, don't give up things you care about. And don't just be responsible. Like, obviously, part of jobs, right, is to provide money to put bread on the table. But she said, and we felt, you know, she and Nathan have all skills that might outstrip their roles that they do. But she said, actually, it's a complete, perfect application of, like, where our passions lie. And don't give that up. And I thought, that's great. Because I knew immediately that's what I want to do, is I want to do more writing. But then I found myself, even as Amanda's, like, talking, I'm multitasking, because in my head I start praying. I think, you know what? But writing memoirs does not pay the bills. You know that. That's common wisdom in writing. So I start asking God, like, what do I do for money? And in that very moment, clear as day, outside thought pops into my head, teach piano. And it was just, like, tears started streaming down my eyes, because I thought, I had not considered that. It's a skill that lies dormant in my past. But it wasn't even on the table, because I was thinking, you know, I got to go through this whole strategic HR process and thinking about jobs where I could actually, like, wear street clothes to work. You know, I just thought, I had not even considered that. Now, there's a few times in my life when it's very clear to me that God is invading my space to direct me. Like, there was one when I and my newlywed husband we were actually engaged, felt like God just downloaded the thought to move out here and help start this church. There was a time when I was considering quitting teaching, and as a non-quitter, it was very, very, very hard to let go. And I felt like Jesus was in a vision in the middle of the night saying, like, it's okay to quit. A third time, I was, like, giving a bagel to a guy I thought was a homeless man, and then I turn around seconds later, he's disappeared. I think it was an angel. So in this moment, I'm like, I think this feels like one of those moments, totally out of the blue, not my own thought train. So now I'm trucking along, and I'm gathering students, and I'm going to have a little piano teaching business. I thought, well, I've never done that before, but somehow it doesn't feel weird. I mean, it doesn't feel scary. It just feels, thank you. But isn't that amazing? Like, I just thought, this is the weirdest thing ever, but I'm doing it. All right. And like Lydia said, for now, I'm so glad not to have to move. You know, I get to be part of this community ongoing, which feels like, as Ivy prayed, fluid. That was a great word, you know, just ongoing. So that gives me joy. So what's the turmoil about that I mentioned earlier, if not about work? Well, recently I crossed paths with someone, a man, who I unexpectedly felt a connection with within only a few hours' time of crossing paths, with whom it's highly unlikely anything would develop. Like, if there was like an adverb for an adjective or something, I would say, like, very highly, really, extremely unlikely something would develop. And since then, I've been a royal mess. I was talking with one of my good friends, and he told me, this is great. This is a symbol. You're ready. It's not about this guy. It's about all the other guys who you could also be a great fit with. And I was like, I don't think so. Despite the fact that my friend is usually right, and I have the very best friends in the world who look out for my best interests, I didn't believe him. I find myself, for the first time in 5 years since becoming a widow, talking like Naomi in the Bible, where based on her discouragement, she actually tries to change her name. We're going to read this together. Read with me from your program. It's in the book of Ruth. Ruth is Naomi's daughter-in-law. This is after Naomi and Ruth both lose their husbands. Chapter 1 says, "So the two of them, Naomi and Ruth, continued on in their journey. When they came to Bethlehem, the entire town was excited by their arrival." "Is it really Naomi?" the women asked. "Don't call me Naomi," she responded. "Instead, call me Mara, for the Almighty has made life very bitter for me. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me home empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has caused me to suffer and the Almighty has sent such tragedy upon me?" So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by her daughter-in-law Ruth, the young Moabite woman. They arrived in Bethlehem in late spring, at the beginning of the barley harvest. Naomi had this happy life. Naomi actually means pleasant. That's what the word means. Which is then upended by her husband dying, her two sons dying, and she's displaced geographically, and then there's a famine. Boom. She arrives at her hometown, and she says, "Call me Mara." She takes stock. She's walking into her hometown, right? She's seeing her hometown people. She's like, "Hi, you're John. I'm bitter. Call me bitter, for short. This recent experience with this guy caught me totally off guard and unnerved me. But even more surprising has been the way I've been related with Naomi. It bothers me that I'm relating with Naomi, though, because I am a staunch optimist. I mean, if you told me that on the way to church today you got both legs cut off, I would think of the guy I saw running the other day on the Jamaica Way with two prosthetic metal limbs. He was rocking his run. And my boys and I are like, look, that's awesome. My mom tells me, she used to tell me, she can't really talk anymore. My mom used to tell me, I can't remember a bad mood that you were in before you were in the third grade. And like, I loved middle school. I was a really positive person, okay? So Naomi always struck me in the years of encountering her story in the Bible. It's like, ew, Naomi, she's so negative. She's so down on faith and life and self-pitying. Ugh. Those qualities turned me off. Now, if you've been here in the last 2 weeks, you've heard Steve frame the story with Naomi being cast opposite Ruth, her daughter-in-law, who's so more obviously positive, faith-filled, confident that God's going to give her a great life, right? Ruth's the hero. But I'm realizing lately what a gift Naomi is in her own right. Naomi tells it the way she sees it. It's crunch time in her current reality when it comes to her going back to her hometown empty-handed. She's not afraid to say she's hurting. It's a marker of where she's at, which ultimately totally gets folded into the miracles that happen later in her life. And I'm wondering if God shows up gloriously in Naomi's crunch time in a way that he couldn't if her life was smooth like glass. Now, I'm not saying God killed off her family so that he could show off. I'm just saying, isn't it interesting? Something about her crying out to him is just, you know, it opens up the situation, I think, in a way that God can work in a new way. In her bitter space, I think Naomi is punting to God and just saying, your move, God. And lo and behold, things play out extremely well as her life takes very dramatic turns for the better before the book is done. But when we first encounter Naomi, her life is very messy. Switching gears for a few minutes, there's a weird story in the book of Luke that Jesus tells about someone whose life is also right in the middle of their story after they've had an initial taste of good spiritual life from Jesus. Jesus tells the story in a way that I think the stakes are totally tied to Naomi's story. So I thought I'd share it, even though it's kind of weird. So if you look on the right column, Jesus said, "When an evil spirit leaves a person, it goes into the desert searching for rest." Now first, just to comment, part of what it seems like many of us experience of getting connected with God is that we can be freed from dark spiritual forces, things that plague us, things that are not logical, not based on circumstance that are obvious, but like spiritual, like oppressive negative thoughts, or people were talking on our website video for our church. It's a cool video. I rewatched it recently. It's like having so much anxiety, you cannot change your mind and just feel better. And feeling like getting in touch with God's power actually does a change. I mean, that's been a big story for many of us. So then Jesus is describing this, and then he's describing this evil spirit that leaves, right? He's personifying it. He says, "When that spirit finds no rest, it says, 'I will return to the person I came from.' So it returns and finds that its former home is all swept and in good order. Then the spirit finds seven other spirits more evil than itself, and they all enter the person and live there. And so that person is worse off than before." As Jesus was speaking, a woman in the crowd called out, "God bless your mother, the womb from which you came and the breast that nursed you." Jesus replied, "But even more blessed are all who hear the word of God and put it into practice." Now first, a couple of comments on reading the Bible. There's this Benedictine practice of going to the Bible with an approach called Lectio Divina, Latin for divine reading. Meaning you kind of read the Bible, and as you contemplate it, you basically put faith that God will reveal something to you as you read it. It's a different approach to reading the Bible than, let's say, systematically organizing what you read into historical context and feeling like you reach an objective understanding. Now, that approach can have all kinds of cool results. You can gain understanding of historical context. Like, if you go to this passage we just read, you might say, oh, like, that's ancient understandings of what evil spirits are, or the desert, or kind of look at that imagery. But that's a little different than the Benedictine practice. The Benedictine practice would say, like, a little bit more like the church leader Paul, who wrote that the Bible is like a living and active sword that kind of reveals our intentions and our attitudes in our heart, and God wants to stir things up. So I'm reading Luke 11 today and wanted to talk about it from that Lectio Divina, Benedictine kind of approach. We'll see what God inspires in us, okay? When you first read the story Jesus tells, it's kind of confusing, right? Why is a well-swept house not a good thing? Why is it a bad thing? Wouldn't you think that our interactions with God, one of the benefits would be that he tidies up our lives, right? If you feel like there's sins or stuff you do that's just been a drag in your life and God frees you from that, wouldn't you think that one of the goals is that your life becomes a little more presentable, right? It's a logical thought. For example, if you experience freedom from addiction because of Jesus' power entering your life, wouldn't your priority be like, at all costs, make sure more than anything else, just stay addiction free? Or if you've had money problems and you think, finally, I'm back on my feet, thank God. Oh my God, just don't spend any money. Just don't get back into trouble. Just say no. Could be our thought. But that's where the surprise is. So you realize that the point of the story Jesus is telling is this particular well-swept house is an empty house. There's nothing going on. And that's why it's vulnerable to danger. The antidote Jesus is prescribing to such a vulnerable house is to become people, he calls, who hear the word of God and do it. It's not just keep away from bad stuff, which my friends with addictions actually say is a tremendous amount of pressure to just say, don't do the bad thing, right? It actually backfires on you most of the time. But instead, Jesus is describing a faith that moves to take risks as you invite God's leadership, to say, I want to move towards the good thing that I feel like God is inspiring in me. Right? But when you move, that faith is messy. It involves choices and actions and inevitably mistakes as you make an effort. But I think what Jesus is implying is it's a life filled with life. It's churning with life and possibilities such that in an interesting spiritual dynamic, it actually protects us from going backwards towards harm. In my own messy way, very messy, I tried to do just that this month. When I was tempted to just go into shutdown mode because of all my swirl of thoughts and feelings. The Tuesday the boys started school, I felt almost this physical urge rise up in me as I was driving, and I thought, I have to go talk to God and just let it all hang out instead of shut it down and soldier on. So I found myself, as I do a few times a year, heading to the cemetery where my late husband's body was buried. And there in front of the granite marker, where his body lies, I just had it out with Jesus and with Andrew as well. I basically found myself saying out loud, like, Andrew, you're the one who in between chemo infusions looked him in the eye and say, if I die, you should remarry. And I thought, well, then do something. Pull some strings, babe. And I was saying similarly blunt things to Jesus. Now, the poor cemetery staff lawnmower guy, they are awesome. They like keep their distance. So someone's over here crying and they just let you do your business. And he like does his other regions. He's like over in the garden of everlasting love or whatever. And Andrew's buried in the garden of meditation. So like they're just staying over there in that section. But at some point he must have been like looking at his watch thinking, I really got to cut that grass. And I think he was actually doing wheelies because the second I stood up to go, there he was. And he swooped in. It was so nice that he waited, though. So after a while of talking and crying out loud to Jesus and Andrew, I had this sense of calm come over me. And it wasn't, mind you, like, oh, this is the word of God for me. It was not with any specific promise. I just felt like, you know, my cries, they actually landed somewhere. It didn't feel like they went flying off into the wind. I felt like they landed. And I felt a tremendous calm and peace and, like, release come over me. So I left. Now that was my experience of Naomi's calmly bitter moment with Ruth and God. And it was my experience of what Jesus described of hearing the words of God and trying to do them versus trying to keep my nice, neat life all in order. Okay, but just to note, there are 7 billion personalities in the world, right? So my version of Naomi's crunch time prayers might be more melodramatic than some of yours. Yours also might not involve a guy on a lawnmower. Yours might resemble more like one of my kids who, when all hell is breaking loose with his brothers and his mother, he raises one eyebrow to register the moment. So your version of Naomi's crunch time prayer might be you're driving and you are at a stoplight and you just say, hey, God, could you help me out? That would be great. I can wonder if Naomi's call me bitter declaration is an important part of what allows her to keep going. We see as the book of Ruth unfolds, Naomi's actually a big player in Ruth going on with her life. She's not lying in bed feeling sorry for herself. And I think that encourages me, right? She's very much present. So it's not as if bitterness caused her total inaction. Later, while still feeling pretty messy myself, I talked with another woman who had real questions about her desires and choices in relationships. And afterwards, I thought about it. That felt like an opportunity to encourage right where they are, my friends, where they are in their own crunch time. And I felt a satisfaction about that, that my experience isn't useless, but it's unto something real and good. Now, granted, Val's love life, it's kind of like middle-of-the-road steaks, right? It's somewhere on the scale between finding the perfect pair of pants and, like, if you're a Syrian refugee trying to get across the water to live, right? We live in a world where life and death stakes are always just a hair away. Do you guys remember just a year ago, the entire world was focused on Western Africa and the Ebola crisis that was happening there and in other isolated cities around the world? Do you remember the story of Kekula Fatu, the 22-year-old Liberian nursing student whose whole family contracted Ebola? So she has a father who gets sick, goes to a hospital. He's put into a bed where the last guy who had that bed died of Ebola. So her father gets Ebola. But then they misdiagnose him. He goes home, gives his wife, his daughter, and his nephew Ebola. So now Kekula Fatu's whole family is in crunch time. This is a disease that had a 25% survival rate. And she's looking at four family members with Ebola. The local doctor doesn't want to come to the house, so she has to be on the phone every day. For 2 weeks straight, every day, Kekula Fatu wakes up, puts on 5 layers of gloves on each hand, stockings on her head, and trash bags on her legs and feet. And she's administering medications through intravenous lines that she starts as a nursing student for her family. Okay, so what's she thinking? Well, amazingly, 75% of her family survives, not 25%. Her cousin, Alfred, tragically dies. He's a teenager. But her father, her mother, and her sister survive. And CNN interviews Kekula Fatu 1 month later when the crisis is over. They say, what were you thinking? This is what she said. At times, she observed that her family's, meaning her patients, blood pressure plummeted so low she feared they would die. She said, I cried many times. I said, God, you want to tell me I'm going to lose my entire family? There's a Naomi-like quality to Kekula's prayers that inspires me. She is not praying entirely optimistically, nor is she serene. But she's crying out honestly in her crunch time to God with her deepest fears of the moment. She's directing her energy to the God she thinks has power and care to respond and do something. By the way, I couldn't help but just reach out to Bill Massacoy and Peter Chu, our friends, one in the stateside and one back in Liberia, our friends who are our touch points for this group called Rebuild Africa, because Bill's back in Liberia. And one of the channels our money goes towards as we partner financially with this church is Rebuild Africa, who's rebuilding Liberia in a focused way. And there's a hike coming up I wanted to mention. So on October 17, Saturday, feel free to pull out your phone and make a note if you want. I think Karen and Tyler, yeah, thanks, guys. So on the 17th, there's going to be a fundraising hike. We're going to fund education for youth. Did you know that $150, which is the cost for one hiker for this hike, can fund half a year of a teenage girl's high school education in Liberia? So if you want to, give money or join the hike. And you can email info@rebuildafrica.org if you want to find out more about that event. Okay, we're going to spend a few more minutes just going through some suggestions I came up with. There's four of them. If you want to, how can we invite Jesus to work in our crunch time? The first suggestion I have is to go face to face with him and be honest about what you're thinking and feeling. I think sometimes I'm so worried that I'll inconvenience someone, I actually block people from trying to care for me. I almost did that this week again. Luckily, I caught it and I re-engaged. I think it's okay to be in crunch time and need people, need something. For those of us who are religious background people, including Christian background people, religion teaches us to be well-behaved and judgmental. We judge ourselves harshly, and we can judge others, too, all the time. But here's what Jesus talks about. He wants a relationship with us. So in John's Gospel, chapter 15, Jesus is quoted as saying, I don't call you servants, I call you friends, because we know each other's business. Think about it. Think about a close friend you have. Do you really make your modus operandi, I really need to behave in front of you, and I really feel like judging you all the time or having you judge me? Jesus is saying, let's be friends. Let's know each other's business. Let me know what's really going on. We allow Jesus to invade our space and us to invade his. And back to Luke 11, where a messy house maybe is a better house. Relationships are live. They're not spick and span. Prayers can also be a very messy conversation as opposed to some performance. So try it out. Second suggestion I have is to meditate on the happy endings that God seems to love writing. Naomi and Ruth's story, we're going to explore a lot in the weeks to come. It's a very inspiring story. And with Kekula Fatu's family, not only did most of them survive, but with that exposure she got with the CNN story, she got so much exposure and support that Emory University in Atlanta offers her a scholarship, which is great because Liberia had to shut down its nursing schools last year due to Ebola, but then because of the scholarship, Kekula Fatu could come to the States and finish her nursing school. She just went home a month ago as a full licensed nurse. Now, a spoiler alert for the rest of our sermon series. At the end of this book of Ruth, Naomi is the great-great-grandmother of the ancient King David, the guy who's considered to be like the royal ancestor of Jesus of Nazareth, the divine human being who's influenced more of humanity, human history on every continent ongoing through to today, 2015, right? So this is all from Naomi, the call-me-bitter woman. That's pretty cool. Thirdly, I suggest this. Lean towards agrarian time as opposed to internet time as you wait for results. Lean towards agrarian time. We live in an era where just this week I was emailing my friend Kathy. She sends me this note. Thank God for FlyFi. So she's flying from Maine, thank you, state of Maine, to San Francisco for work. She's 35,000 feet in the air, and she and I are chatting. I'm on the ground in Boston, and we're just setting up logistics for when we're next hanging out. And we do that in like 3 minutes. And she's somewhere moving 500 miles an hour over some state somewhere. Amazing, right? The world we live in. Well, here's a different kind of sense of time. It's from a strange story in the laws Moses apparently got from God and then passed on to the ancient Israelites. It's farming time. Moses wrote this. It's on your program, too, at that bottom left-hand corner. When you enter the land and plant fruit trees, leave the fruit unharvested for the first 3 years and consider it forbidden. Do not eat it. In the fourth year, the entire crop must be consecrated to the Lord as a celebration of praise. Finally, in the fifth year, you may eat the fruit. If you follow this pattern, your harvest will increase. I am the Lord your God. Maybe timing is something like this. There's a temptation all the time, I certainly have it, to go for our version of the happy ending, right? Hollywood time, movie, 2 hours, let's go. Peter Jackson, 3.5 hours, too long. It's just, that's what it is. And I think that's symbolized by the first 3 years of fruit. That's us, smooth sailing. That's what I want. But I think what this hints at in Leviticus is something gets better over time if we're willing to wait it out and acknowledge that even better than results could be this notion, the Lord is my God. God is the ultimate reward. Being connected to the God who made us over the long haul is actually better. Now, how does this work in real life, right? Take my longing for love. I think God's saying that's a good longing, but somehow longer lasting and even better than me giving you a lover is me, meaning God, being your lover. Me totally being yours to access all the time, to provide for you, to make your entire life better than okay, but actually well. Now, it's an act of faith for me to embrace that, right? It kind of reminds me of like when I was a married person, I'd say to my single friends, stuff like that, and I think, oh, like how is that any different? I could read that as like, oh, it's just a pat on the head and saying, oh, just let go of your frustrations and your longing. It's not much. And that's why I think waiting is only doable with an actual relationship with God. Like when I ask God directly, well, what should I do for pay work? And I feel like God actually talked to me and said, you know what? Teach piano. And so I'm on my way. And I feel like that loop got closed. I felt uncertain. It was fact. In fact, God loving me. So I'd suggest be willing to expand your sense of due time. Even when you see initial signs of good things from God, maybe don't leap on it, because sometimes we could squelch the bigger thing God's up to. I find it helpful to just ask God what to do and what not to do. For those of us who lean passive, I'm not suggesting to hide behind a noble idea of waiting for perfection. Remember, we are God's partners. We're invited to change the world and to activate our lives. And crunch time requires us taking risks. But for those of us who lean active with a carpe diem, seize the day kind of personality, which is more like me, just for fun, we could try doing only prayer for a while and see what happens. Pray honestly, whatever you want. But try doing basically little else. We could see what happens, right? I've had friends say, hey, you know what? I'm so worked up and I'm so driven at work. I'm just going to like chill out for a month and pray for my work situation and see if anything changes. I wonder if Naomi looked back years later, like maybe from heaven, and gave a chuckle and thought, huh, isn't it interesting that in the middle of my story, I felt compelled to declare my life bitter and bad? I wonder if she thought, you know what if I just said, I'm going to hang in there and just see what develops. And maybe in the meantime, she could have had a few more happy weekends along the way. Lastly, here's the last suggestion. Make markers everywhere that remind you of where God shows up. Naomi, again, arriving in her hometown, in her crunch time, she had to get it out. Her marker was, call me Mara. She's saying, this is a bad life. But did you notice she arrives to the beginning of the harvest? Did you read that? They arrived in Bethlehem in late spring at the beginning of the barley harvest. I see harvest all around me all the time. Even these last few weeks, when I've been a mess and I felt down about things, there's been an abundance of goodness. My three kids are settling well into school. I mean, that was not a given for those of you who know what happened last year. They're making new friends. They're managing their schedules well. It's like, it's great. I mentioned the weather already, right? I have a basement project. The house basement project is finishing. And like the contractor and the subs and I have like a mutually respectful relationship. And that's a minor miracle, right? You'd be like, I'm glad we work together. And we can both say that. My next chapter of work life is unfolding with amazing ease and generous assistance from so many people. I have the best friends in the world. If you don't have friends that you can call that, like, go after them. Try to make a friend. Because I've put in a little time, but what I get back is just like this outpouring tidal wave of care and concern and love. And even dating, if I really think about it, even every single dating experience has given me a gift where I can say, you know what, this gives me an appreciation for people. And it gives me insight into my strengths and my weaknesses, right? That feels like a gift from God of how to move forward in life. So I'm making markers. There's often an early harvest right in your crunch time. I think crunch time is brimming with opportunities. It's not always obvious how long our individual crunch time goes on. I feel like mine's been going on for years. But sometimes crunch times are very brief. I will probably continue to be an optimist. That's just how I'm wired. But one thing I know for sure is that optimism alone does not get me through crunch time. The best thing I'm learning right now is my relationship with Jesus. It gives me total permission to open myself up ongoing in crunch time with no pressure for my own solutions. As I do that, I'm finding Jesus is coming to that space anew, afresh, and has a lot he wants to do for me and probably through me. So I'd love to pray for all of us if you want that. We could pray together and then we get to find out some awesome things God's seeming to do through prayer from our friend Lexi. Come by your spirit here, God, and enliven our senses to your reality. I find myself thinking of my friend Kathy, 35,000 feet in the air, and thinking, well, you're there with her, God, and you're there with me on the ground in Boston. Thanks that you're, I don't know, God of internet time and farming time. And you can work backwards. I feel like sometimes you cycle me backwards in time to just review something that happened in the past in order to heal it or inspire me. And so I pray, God, that in every crunch time, past, present, or future, you would allow us to access your goodness and relationship with you. In Jesus' name, amen.